It's a great pleasure this afternoon to have Dr. Richards with us. She's done field work in Zambia among the Bemba, in Uganda, and most recently in Eldon, not very far away from here. But today we've asked her if she would open a discussion on field work in the 1930s, and then I hope you will join in and ask questions about the problems involved. Audrey.
Well, Bill Epstein came to see me about a fortnight ago and said, how is it that you people in the 30s collected so much more material than any of us do nowadays? I don't know if that's true. If so, why is it true? I think possibly it is because we started with the idea, which seems naive now, no doubt, of studying a whole unit, a whole tribe, a whole society, whatever it is, whereas you people, when I talk to you, say, I'm going to study one special aspect, I'm going to study a particular kind of possession in a particular society, a particular kind of adoption in another society, and that I think makes rather a different way entry into the work. I can remember Malinowski running down the platform at Victoria when I started doing field work in 1930, carrying, to my great regret, about 14 coloured pencils and saying, remember what I told you, brown for economics, red for politics, blue for ritual. As we passed down the platform a little bit further, he produced a great many cards, and he said, now this is the linguistic stuff. You have yellow for adjectives, blue for so-and-so, and red for proverbs or sayings or whatever it was. Well, I bundled into the carriage with the elastic bands breaking in the unwounded burden that they had to carry. But it did, I think, show that he really was trying to study a whole society. It was part of his theory, of course. But how do you study a whole society? How do you start doing it? People tell me they can't do it. They've no idea how to do it. Well, of course, with a scheme. And someday I must make a slide of the Malinowski schemes with the different columns that you had to fill in. And when I say you had to fill in, that was expected that you would fill in. Very broad headings like politics, agriculture, witchcraft, this, that and the other. And I think it made for these tribal studies, which were then current. Well, can you study a whole society in that way? And you might just as well ask, perhaps, how can you study your special problem unless you study a whole society? And that is one of the problems everyone has to face, whether they're in the 1930s or now. Can you get sufficient detail if you take the broad study? I think I would have got much more detail probably if I hadn't been fascinated by taking the whole aspects of Bemba culture, particularly these different kinds of chieftainship, 20 or 30 different kinds of chieftainship, necessitated going to the headquarters of each chief. I went, I think, to 26 different villages, and Elizabeth Colson, you see, stuck in one village the whole time. Of course, I didn't have such close personal relationships as Elizabeth Colson no doubt did in her village, but I was somehow impelled by the desire. I've been to that chieftainship. I must go there. And as I say, I went to 26 different villages in that way. Well, you are always then giving up the very detailed and very exact observation for the general outline. If I were to have plenty of money now, I would do the general outline first on some kind of Malinowski scheme or any other scheme that you chose to start out with, and do the more detailed study later. I think I lost out in detail what I might have had if I'd stuck to one village. But that, I'd like to know what you think about that. I mean, about the general study is distinct from the particular study.
I think it's very different, isn't it? If you're, I mean, I had two experiences rather like the one of Elizabeth Colson and your Bemba one. In the Bemba one, where we were working in a, you know, an area with chiefship and a centralized state, I mean, there I too, you know, had to go round from one place to another and did a sort of peripatetic fieldwork. But when I was in the sort of simpler society, without any sort of overall political structure, I mean, then it seemed to be more profitable to stay where I was and to get that. So I suppose it depends. I mean, if you're working in something which is complex like the Bemba, or the Baganda, then you're doing that. Whereas if you're working, you know, in Elmden, then you're sort of staying in one, you know, one village and doing the people intensely. So I suppose it rather depends on what the nature, you know.
That probably is true.
Yeah.
But remember, we had the idea that it was very important to describe each tribe. This was a fantastic ambition when you consider it now, but people would say when giving grants or giving money or discussing where they'd go, well, we must study the X's. You know, we've got no account of the X's. Well, I don't know how many tribes there are in Africa, which was the first continent taken by the 1930 lot. But there must be some 600 or 700. Well, more, I should
think.
Yes,
I think so.
But we had the idea. We couldn't have a blank on the map. We couldn't have the X's on which no monograph had been written. That would be a terrible thing. Well, here is Miss Jones come along, anxious to go somewhere. Send her to the X's, because that will fill up our map and get us going get us part of the way going.
I think all anthropology has tended to develop between this general conspectus that you were talking about, that Malinowski encouraged you to come to grips with, the aspects of culture listed and compared with other cultures. But we do tend to move between specific problems and general conspectuses. And out of your general survey of the Bemba came a book, Land, Labour and Diet, which was dealing with some quite specific issues. Was this not correct? Can you explain how you began to feel the specific subject matter of your book emerged out of your general studies of these 26 or thereabouts? Was it 26?
Well, there were 26 places where I more or less settled, yes. 26 chieftainships.
How did you start to feel that these particular problems of diet, of food, of women, perhaps, how did these interests start to coalesce in your mind?
Well, don't the people studied really shove you in one direction or another? I don't believe, as the Oxford people, Evans Pritchard at one time said, don't train for field work, just go into the area and absorb the culture, get the atmosphere. Well, I'm against these atmospheric studies because I think you rather waste time just sopping up the cut. We had one or two out at McKellery, didn't get to work so quickly. But I think that after you've been in an area a certain length of time, some problem comes up because the people talk about it so much, because the people insist on, you're studying it almost, fancy going to the X's, who we know are very backward, and they only have patrilineal clans, you know. Well, all the best people are matrilineal here. They only have patrilineal. I just wouldn't go to them if I were you. I mean, you're partly shoved by the people studied, and partly by the inability to get very much further until you've narrowed down on one particular thing. But I would be, if I had plenty of money, I would beg people to go for 1 year for a general study, and then when the problem of problems emerged, concentrate on that and do as detailed study as possible. I don't know what you think.
But Audrey, were you not really, wasn't it really more focused than that, because you had a training in the natural sciences? Your first book, which was before you had done field work?
No.
It was after you'd started?
Yeah.
But you were interested in problems to do with food and nutrition, and there was this scheme of the International Africa Institute, which was encouraging people to look into problems to do with native nutrition and so on, and you were working with Dr. Whittison, who was a nutritionist. I mean, so that you were, in a sense, focused. I mean, within that study, you were focused on certain areas.
Not till the second year I'd been there. You see, I really worked on political systems. They happened to interest me very much. Mm-hmm. I didn't get on to the detailed nutrition work until the second year. I ran it alongside of studies of ritual and politics.
Yes.
I mean, I regarded it as a sort of employment for, as Isaac Walton said, an employment for one's leisure time, which is then not idly spent. I didn't regard it as a...
So that hunger and work came after you had started fieldwork?
Yes. Yeah.
And that interest in nutrition and so on came after you had already begun?
Oh, yes.
The fieldwork?
Yes. Mm.
Some of your earlier statements about fieldwork methods are about survey methods. Is that not correct? In Malinowski's collection on methods of study of culture contact in Africa, you have an essay on household survey methods. Did that interest in numerical techniques, sort of systematic sociological techniques, did that arise out of your Bemba work, or did you go into your Bemba work determined that you would be scientific in that sense?
Well, we were all trying to be very scientific and as clever as the mathematicians and the physicists and the natural scientists, and that was the great craze at the time. But I think it was Raymond Firth who first started doing numerical studies, and Malinowski, with very absolutely no statistics really, it seemed to us very dramatic that he had actually counted what was given in presents from one side of the family to the other, because people doing field work at that time had never counted anything, and that seemed to start. But we had no training in statistics. When I tell you, to my shame, that I published something on a random sample, well, never having read anything about statistics, I thought a random sample were any old set of people who happened to be passing, who I asked about cross-cousin marriage, and they all told me that.
Yes. Then you mean when they were all women going to market on a certain Thursday?
might be that. But probably the cross-cousin marriage stuff wasn't so severe, but so dangerous. But afterwards I came in contact with the two sophists who were trained sociologists, who came to McKellery, and I learned what a random sample was, but I can't tell you how naive we were on that side. But you see, Fraser thought it was marvelous that Malinowski really counted the number of presents given for the Uri Gubu or whatever it was. He thought it most exciting and dramatic. So I'm told I've not read his letters at Trinity, but I'm told by one of the Leonards that that appears. And when I did the first village survey that I did, every hut I went into, I found some new kind of marriage or new kind of thing. And I thought, well, we must go in for these village surveys. There's nothing for it, regrettable as it is, and to my mind.
So apart from the coloured pencils, what specific bits of advice did Malinowski give to his body of students at fieldwork, for fieldwork?
We never had any teaching on fieldwork. It was a very small group, as you realise. It was a very combative group because we thought, led by him, that we simply were the cat's whiskers and that nobody had done any field work but us. There were certain straw men who appeared, like the terrible stories of American field workers paying $4 an hour to Indians to give them material. And we resolved immediately, without saying anything, that we would never pay anyone for anything. And I never did that in the end because it was sort of ingrained in me. No, I think the training was really arriving suddenly at the LSE and finding that the lecture wasn't in the place where it was supposed to be, and that Malinowski on all fours had his land tenure material all over the floor in a room about twice this side, and we all scrabbled round on all fours picking this up. Well, it teaches you something. You can't defend it intellectually as as a way, because it was a very rare kind of land tenure, but it taught you something.
How to crawl.
How to crawl. You caught the infection of the tremendous enthusiasm, and you realised what you must not do when you were doing a land tenure study. Then I went to a society with very little organised land tenure, so it didn't help me very much. No, it was a thing by example, and the influence of a very small group, about six or seven people, who told you what they had done. Raymond Firth came back with Mari's stuff. Later on, E.P. came back with kinship stuff from these, and he never lectured to my memory on magic and witchcraft, but he did lecture on his kinship stuff. And that is the way, and I suppose that still goes on. One field worker learns from another more than any other way. It's rather terrifying when you're sitting in the field on the equator on a very hot season to get a letter from the Canadian anthropologist Gordon Brown saying, I have been taking quarter of an hour observations on children's play and games for a period of 3 weeks. Well, hardly had you sat down at your camp table and had your cup of tea relentlessly bought by every African servant at any hour of the day when the horrible little things had started doing something else and you had to go on and then write to Gordon Brown and compare your results with his. Well, that was informal teaching, if you like, informal inspiration.
Who were the six playmates crawling about the floor, Malinowski's floor, at that time, Audrey?
I think that Raymond Firth had now had gone. Yes. Hortense Powdermaker.
Oh, yes.
Shapira.
Yes.
I can't remember what they called Nardell Fortis and Godfrey Wilson.
Yes.
Had some special name, and they were very leading people, but we were very few to crawl. I mean, we didn't make a decent crawl at all.
Yes.
Can I ask about another question? The functional conspectus that Malinowski had in mind now, of course, seems very bold. It also, to us, very often implies a degree of specialist knowledge. I mean, to understand, to be able to describe the economics of a particular group of people plausibly. Nowadays, you have to know, I think, quite a bit of economics.
Yeah.
If you're interested in politics, there's a huge literature in political science that one feels one perhaps ought to have some kind of acquaintance with. Do you feel, has interdisciplinarity been important to you? Do you think it has arisen naturally out of your early work with Malinowski? The reason I ask this is because you are noted later on at Makerere in the East African Institute of Social Research for your interest in interdisciplinary studies, bringing anthropology into conjunction with other disciplines. Was that an early interest or a late interest? How would you describe it appearing?
No, I think it was a late interest, and I don't know quite what it arose from. Connections with psychology at the LSE, running joint seminars with people there, but it certainly wasn't taught.
I think to be an anthropologist, one of the luxuries about anthropology is its eclecticism. You can be an anthropologist and you can be interested in plants, language, politics, cooking. Jack has just written a book on cooking, I think.
Have you written a book on cooking?
Yes, but we're not discussing that now.
Sorry, Jack. And is this one of the pleasures of anthropology to you?
Yes, it is. It's one of the pleasures, and it's also not a hereditary endowment, but I have natural... I'm very extrovert, put it that way.
Divergent interests.
Yes. Mm. It's a drawback in a way.
There are two kinds of anthropologists, again, I think, too, just as there are two kinds of intellectual predilection. There are people who are very convergent, go deep into single problems, and there are people who are very divergent, are interested in going across the surface of a lot of problems. Maybe anthropologists prosper best if they're interested in the latter.
Well, I would say you couldn't be deeply interested in one problem unless you saw it against a setting of a wider society.
Audrey, could I bring us back to the fieldwork theme? Because you've been describing what kind of training
lack of training
that you got from Malinowski. And that other people got from Malinowski. Yet these were the people who, at the same time, were those who, according to Epstein, collected much more material than subsequent ones did, and yet they received no training. Yet you've been involved at the LSE because Edmund Leach has spoken to me about it. And, of course, when you were here, and particularly at Elmdon, in encouraging people to do field work and, to some extent, in training them in some way or other. I mean, do you think field work, people can be trained for the field?
I think they can be trained in certain techniques. I think they can be trained in note-taking, and their notes, we did criticise some of their notes taken at Elmdon, what they'd left out, what they'd suggested the answers to, were saying, I mean, do you hate your daughter-in-law?
That's the sort of interviewing technique, yes.
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 Yeah.
Yes.
I think you could train that. You can train them, really, I think, only in an attitude of mind. I don't know that I trained anyone at Makerere. I did have the old-fashioned idea. I went out in 1950. I did have the old-fashioned idea that here we were in the heart of Buganda, that we had a set of tribes round us which had not been described. I consider this an old-fashioned idea, but we had it. And the plan was to describe, first of all, to send people, first of all, to the undescribed tribes round Kampala, and then to proceed on this basis that there were some so-called tribes without rulers, which is a fantastic term, but there were people of that sort. There were people of very highly organized chieftainships, Buganda, Bunyoro, Angoni, and so on. So that we then proceeded, or I then proceeded, into a series of looking for types. We didn't publish because death and various other things occurred. We were going to do comparative clan structures in this Indo-Lacustrine area because it was a very interesting series of comparison. Priscilla Reining had some interesting stuff. Fallas had some very good stuff, which has never yet been published, and I hope it will be published. Martin Southold had a little stuff on clans, but was not so interested in that. Who was the other one? Malcolm Rule, you see, went to quite a different type of society. That was a dream that never came to, never, I don't know what dreams do when they are fulfilled.
In that case, you were sort of organizing people to go to different field areas to do, as you say, descriptive work that, because people hadn't done anything on those particular groups. I was really thinking of an earlier phase of at LSE, where you got people to go out and go to the market and observe and do little papers on that kind of thing. I mean, you did that with Edmund Leach there and others. I mean, you used to organize fieldwork classes then for people,
yes,
who were going out to the field.
Because we decided that the Rupert Street Market, do you know the Rupert Street Market?
No.
Well, it's a market that supplies the hospitals around that area, the Soho area,
yes,
with a good deal of, there's an Italian hospital and a French hospital and this hospital, the other, there's a good deal of variety in the thing. And I thought it would be a good idea as a practice. I didn't know how it would work. And when I told the students, well, there are 26 of you going out, so I suppose we should really know something, we get 26 accounts. They said, oh no, Miss Richards, because we're all studying the same thing. So that shows that they were really at quite an element. Leach himself was in that group, and he, of course, went straight for the problem. You can't have a market unless you have an organizer of the market, unless you have rules of marketing, unless you have a set of places where the goods all go, and so on. And he wrote rather a good study of the Rupert Street Market. The others wandered round and followed their own taste, what they happened to be interested in. Barbara Morris and Stephen were in that study also, and Jacques Maquet.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any other sort of schemes like that that you used for getting people to go out and observe and report?
I don't think so, except the Cambridge market. The two Strathans went out to the Cambridge market, but somehow it was more, it should have been easier because it was so near, but somehow people weren't interested in the working of the Cambridge market. I don't know why.
Hmm.
May have been rather difficult. So
you mean the students weren't interested?
Yes, apparently. I think so. But they were very much interested in the Elmdon study because it was new to them. And they reacted well to having one family history to study. So Vanessa Meyer took the Hammonds, so-and-so took the, a series of different things.
Yes.
And they really, Anne Whitehead took a series of families, and they really did well on that and enjoyed it. And
so you allocated them sort of, in a sense, different families, plunged into the genealogies of this family.
As a result of experience,
yes,
that the whole of Elmdon was too much to do, that they worked very well when they went to one family and said, can you tell me the history of your house, the actual physical house? And then it all came pouring out. And they'd say, oh, you must see Uncle Bert, he knows more about this than anybody else. And they gradually ramified out from one family. That was very fruitful, I think.
Did this begin with some detailed training in how to take a genealogy, what a genealogy was?
The point of it was to study taking genealogies, and they started taking genealogies, and we told them they'd done it wrong. I mean, we gave them such criticism as we could. It's not so. We also took genealogies at the LSE, genealogies of the staff and genealogies of so-and-so. Not so easy to take a genealogy when you start, or to wrest all the material out of a genealogy.
Yes, because as you say, natural science was your kind of ideal in the days when you were a student. Then I'm wondering, how did they tie up the lack of training or the, you know, lack of interest in giving very detailed training with this ideal of natural science as a model? Was there any kind of, conflict between the two ideals?
I don't think consciously there was. I think that we were in close relations with the sociologists, the Association of Sociologists, I forget what it is, and really were a bit scornful to them and said, which was really true, that we knew more about kinship in the North Country in England at a time when they were administering benefit along kinship lines and making people who had relatives call on their relatives for help. We told the sociologists in our arrogant way that we knew more about the kinship because we had a plan to look for genealogies than they did, and I think that was probably true.
In a sense, then, the person, I mean, the kind of person you are also influences to a large extent the fieldwork that you do. You just mentioned that the society you go to sometimes forces you into a particular area of research. Would you also say that the kind of person you are influences, I think, to a large extent how you create your field and study it?
Yes, I think you must. I think you couldn't try to get over your own drawbacks, either in training or in aptitude, but I think it must make, don't you think it does make an effect?
I wonder what influence, surely your, how would you say your personality is expressed in your field work?
A too wide interest in all sorts of different things, I think. But
yes, I've always wanted to ask you, Dr. Richards, about something that we still don't get any discussion in our training for the field, and that is what kind of either benefit or drawback it was to be a woman in the field in 1930.
I think it's very, very much easier. People always said to me, when I came back, photographs appeared in the Evening Standard, which was then that kind of papers, Miss Richards on her bicycle. I said, well, I live on a sixth-floor flat in Chancery Lane. It'd be rather difficult, this bicycle. Said, oh, they said nothing. We do want to take the actual bicycle. Mm-hmm. And you're standing by the bicycle because you're a woman. Mm-hmm. And that went on for some time. I think it's rather easier to be a woman in a lot of ways. When things were bad in Buganda, when the Kabaka was deported, you see, the women got out into the villages. The men didn't, partly because they thought that the women couldn't possibly be colonial officials.
I found in the Middle East that it's still true that you're less of a threat, if you, particularly if you're asking political questions.
It would be what?
You're less of a threat when you're asking political questions. Was that true then? When you were studying chiefship and things, did they find you less threatening to answer to sensitive political questions because you were a woman?
I'm afraid I didn't get that.
Do you find that being a woman is less threatening to your substance, people, to your subjects? People will talk to you perhaps more freely about political matters because
you're
a woman?
Oh, yes, because I always worked in the colonial period, and it was clear that whatever else I was or was not, I was not a district officer. Mm-hmm. I was sometimes taken for a nurse, only they didn't happen to have travelling nurses there. This had the drawback that you were brought sick babies to deal with, and I think I was no worse than the old mothers, grandmothers of these sick babies, but certainly probably no better. So there was identification with any white welfare worker. I think that did happen. I don't think you could.
Caroline.
Audrey, I was going to ask, how important to you was it in your fieldwork having this communication with other anthropologists in other fields or with Malinowski or other people back in London? How much did you learn from writing to them and getting their answers back about new things you might look at and so on?
Well, of course, this is a question of transport. There was no air traffic when I was in what is now Zambia. In fact, I was there when the first aeroplane came down at Mpika, one of these areas. And that's another story which would take me far away. It took 6 weeks to get a letter from Zambia down to the Cape and round to England. I never had any comment from Malinowski or anyone else. I don't know if he would have sent comments, but I certainly never had them. When I went out to the Institute at McKellery, there were several American workers, particularly pupils of Herzkowitz, who had to give regular reports of what they'd done and were ticked off for not having answered question three or question five. Our people didn't have that. I never had that because it was too far away, and I call that a great advantage, really.
Malinowski visited you in Bemba country, didn't he?
He came round to visit all his students. He had a lectureship at Johannesburg, and he therefore went down by Wagner, by me, by Hilda Cooper, who else? I can't remember who else he did, staying about a week or a fortnight in each place. And though in a way you can say you learn much about field method, you've got an idea of his extraordinary linguistic gifts. And the way, like the real linguist, he picked up a whole phrase with very good memory and almost perfect intonation. He had a very good ear in a situation. Sometimes it had a drawback. For instance, we were standing by the river and a canoe came in with two or three men standing in it. And I shouted out, "Kulichi," which was the, "What? How has it been with you?" And they replied, "Grandmother, we are cold. We have come from a death," meaning that they couldn't come in contact with their wives, they couldn't cook by the fire, they couldn't do this. Well, I didn't know Malinowski was even listening, but next day the chief came down the road, and the chief said, "How are you?" And he said, "Sir, I've been caught by death. I am cold." The chief immediately said, "Oh dear, Hesabana had a telegram, has he had a letter? Should we have mourning for this man? He must have had a telegram." Well, it has disadvantages, but it also has advantages that you pick up a whole sentence in a context. Lorna Gobrown, my friend, had that same gift.
Did he go through your field notes with you to see how, checking on how you were doing?
No, because he didn't stay. He attended two ceremonies with him. Rather difficult in such a short time. Mm-hmm. He did field work of his own because he couldn't bear not to be observing something. He took on house building, and you could hear him. He always counted in Polish to the end of his days. You would hear him measuring inside the hut, going on inside the hut. And that he didn't need a study of witchcraft, which was a group of witch finders going around the village. But I don't think he could have been born to stay there and not do something on his own.
Audrey, you said at the very beginning that at your time, when you went out into the field, you went to look at the whole culture, right? And I remember when I read the first classics of British social anthropology, that I was struck by the capability of giving in a short time, in a few pages, a whole picture showing the interconnection, say, of politics, economics, kinship, and so on and so forth. And at that time, I tended to think that that task was easier when, say, those kind of societies were still very much integrated, and especially were sort of blank subjects before somebody like you went out and did the job. What I'd like to ask you now is, how much do you think the fact of having to work on blank material was affected by Malinowski's theoretical approach, that is, functionalism, and how much, conversely, the fact of working on blank materials and having forcibly to collect all sorts of information fed back on the theoretical bias that you had when you went back and had to write down about your fieldwork?
I think that's a very difficult. I think that's a very difficult question to answer. I think that I won't speak for the other people, a sense of pattern that a rather simple, naive scheme, if you like, that there must be a kinship system, there must be a family and kinship system, there must be a system of relationship of men to land, some kind of land tenure, I had files for all these things, you see, an economic file, a political file, a ritual file, and so on, and I put the notes in and filed them in. It was not very sophisticated, but it was certainly based on the functional idea that all these things existed and they were all interrelated. People say everything is related to everything else, so what? But it is also true that it's a very good exercise to take one subject and work out its relationship.
But I always thought that there must have been a link between the theoretical approach and the state and the conditions of those groups you went to study.
You mean that you wouldn't have made the same study if you'd gone, say, to a very hierarchically organized political system, as if you'd gone to a much less organized tribes without rulers, as Middleton called it? You'd adopt a different technique.
Well, I don't know about that. What I know is that today it is much more difficult to do that. I mean, even to try to do that kind of thing, because things have got, so to speak, messed up. I mean, you go, say, in a traditional peasant society, and you find that there are different systems interconnected with each other, many times in contradiction, many times inexplicably alike each other, although they come from different, say, from societies outside, and so on and so forth, which certainly can't be the basis for any functionalist study, as you intended in that time.
I think it is much easier to make a study of a tribe that is still following its political ideals, that is still really an organizer. I think it's much easier to do that. But I think you can start in the same way, collecting your material with this idea in your mind of getting the interrelation between the political and the...
I was very impressed with East African Chiefs, which you know we've been working on again, how there was a great deal of consensus amongst the people with whom Audrey was working on that collection of essays, surveying East African chiefs. And very impressed by the extreme difficulty Audrey had when she tried to revise it, produce a set of new essays in the 1960s. Our intellectual ideas were atomized. There were political atomizations. There were political problems in the States. You know, I think the remarkable thing about your early field work is you had this clear framework of expectations of the Bemba or of any other group of people, and a sense of a task to perform, a clear sense of a task to perform. Our students perhaps today have a much less clear sense of the task which they
Indeed.
Should be performing.
Well, but Cesare was suggesting that this really was to do with the way that society has been transformed in between the 1930s and the present day, or the types of society that were chosen. I don't think that is true, and I don't think it's you can really support it, in the sense that, and the kind of things that Audrey has been was working on, well, first of the Bemba, who were after all not all that distant from the radical changes that were about to take place even then. Secondly, in Uganda, where certainly things were very hot with the Kabaka's affair and so on, and then in a village near here, which was perhaps not a hot village in that kind of sense, but at least, you know, things have been changing over time. I think that to revert to the fieldwork idea, that really there was something in the fact that these people were largely going in to do fieldwork at a time when, as you remarked and other people remarked, there was very little background material on these chaps. They were going into areas which, in a sense, were non-literate, and which, to some extent, even the written records that we have available now were not available to them. That is, the Public Record Office didn't have. I mean, you couldn't go back and look.
Well, there were censuses, of course.
There weren't censuses, and there weren't these kind of things. So that you really were forced to look at the present and what was happening in the present, and to look at the interrelationships between things that were happening there, and that's what your notebooks were full of. I mean, I find there's a terrible tendency in anthropologists to not look at the present, but to start inquiring backwards, you know, as to what is happening in Anglo-Saxon England or something like that, and get to the roots of things, which take themselves away from the present. And this is particularly true, perhaps, if you're in a sense chasing a tribe, I mean chasing a traditional tribe, which is no longer traditional, that you know, you're not looking at the situation. People are not looking at the situation, you know, as it is there, that's in front of them. And I would have thought that was one of the factors that you know, led people to do this, that they were taking a small segment of time. It is quite true that they weren't looking at sort of, you know, the contradictions of presses over time, but partly, I suppose, because you simply didn't have the materials to do that, that we have now. I mean, people forget that, you know, you can now look at the Public Record Office for, you know, up till 1950, whereas even when I went out in 1950, there was a 50-year rule, so you could see nothing until 1900. So that tells you exactly how much of the earlier period you could get information on of that, you know, of that kind. And it wasn't until it was reduced to 30 that you could get this, in a sense, this background. So perhaps that was part of it. I mean, you were concentrating on the, I mean, whatever you were doing, as in the Ondine study, looking back, I mean, there was a lot of concentration on what was happening, I think, in the here and now.
But of course, we had the records, the parish records,
you
and
did
so on.
You did for the
in
Ondine
the
thing.
English village.
Yes. Yes, you did for the Ondine thing. But even so, I mean, what I think stands out in that study is distinct from, you know, the many studies that historians have done in English Village, is that you had a lot of people there who were looking at what was going on. I mean, that was the difference. And they were starting from that, in a sense, they were starting from that point of view.
And I would think in a modern conditions in Africa, you can go into council meetings and you can go in and out of all sorts of political activities and elections and so on, which in the old days you couldn't have. done.
Phil.
Yes, I wanted to return to this problem of doing fieldwork in the 1930s within a colonial context. I mean, you mentioned earlier on that being a woman was somehow an advantage to you within a colonial context because there was no danger of you being mistaken for a political officer or part of the colonial regime. And I wondered really, I'm really asking two questions. Firstly, about what kind of relationship existed between you as a group of anthropologists and the colonial authority, and what kind of effect that relationship had on your relationship with the people that you studied, either as men or as women. I mean, the way in which the people viewed you, because they would obviously see you arriving in their villages. You would have to explain yourself to them before they would be likely to explain themselves to you. And one would expect that they would look for models, other models of white people, in order to contextualise your explanation of yourself. And I just wondered what that structure of relationships was, and whether it was advantageous or not to the anthropological end.
Whether it was what?
Whether it was advantageous or not. I mean, to be in that colonial context, what effect that had on your work as anthropologists?
That's a very difficult one. I think that Malinowski told us wrongly not to have any contact with white officials or in a colonial situation, and in a certain extent that was an advantage, but it was quite unscientific, of course. You were in villages where white officials came round and took censuses. Of course, your friendships with various white officials were known. All white women scientists were very much disliked by colonial officers, women more than men, I think. They felt an anxiety about women. That girl will be raped in a fortnight. Well, to those of you who are more tender-minded, that never occurred to me. And they felt a great... The white officials felt wished you weren't a woman and wished you weren't there, and really gave you very little, except in one or two cases, gave you no help at all. As regards how the Africans saw it, they would note who you went to, who you stayed with, who you did so and so, and draw certain conclusions, but I don't think they were so much interested. I don't know.
Yeah, I wondered about it because there was a certain amount of work that was done in the 30s and 40s, I think, which was done with the encouragement of the British government, with the encouragement of the colonial administration, in order to make the job of administration much easier. I'm thinking of Nardell, I think, when he worked in the Sudan, around that area. He was actually working for the government, in a sense, to provide them with
information to enable them to...
Yes, that's right, in West Africa too.
Widely, and also in West Africa.
But you seem to have said that there was some kind of ambivalence, at least between you as an anthropologist and the colonial authorities. And I wondered whether you really had to make a positive effort with the Bemba to persuade them that your relationship with the colonial authorities was of that order, and that they shouldn't feel that you were part of that group of people. And did you have to go through any procedure with them to show them that you were separate?
I don't think I went through any procedure, but I did sometimes publicly dissociate myself from a very unpopular and I thought unjust district officer, saying that everyone's not the same. There are good and bad, as you know.
It's not a problem unique to
Audrey, I think that moving on to the colonial field, as you said to me earlier on, is in a sense moving into a different one in those particular relationships, an interesting one. I mean, we all have the problems with administration, I think, in anywhere we are. And perhaps I ought to call the session to an end here, as we have moved on to a different topic. And thank you very much indeed for coming along and talking to us.
Well, thank you very much for listening so patiently.
Thank you. I'm sorry if we went on.